Chapter 5, Witch Hunts. A quotation from Eric Hoffer. Mass movements can arise and spread without belief in a god, but never without belief in a devil. Maoist, McCarthyite, Jacobin, and above all, witch hunt. These terms are sometimes applied to the sorts of events we described in the last chapter. Those who apply such terms are claiming that what we are witnessing on campus exemplifies a situation long studied by sociologists, in which a community becomes obsessed with religious or ideological purity and believes it needs to find and punish enemies within its own ranks in order to hold itself together. From the 15th through the 17th century, Europe experienced multiple waves of witch hunts, driven primarily by religious wars and conflicts in the wake of the Reformation, and also by fears brought on by recurring plague outbreaks. Tens of thousands of innocent people, and possibly hundreds of thousands, were put to death, often after being put to the question, that is, tortured, with the aid of boiling oil, red-hot iron bars, or thumbscrews. The most famous witch hunt in U.S. history occurred in Salem, Massachusetts. In January of 1692, two young girls began to suffer from fits and tremors, which their elders attributed to witchcraft. In the following months, dozens of people claimed that they were tormented by witches, or that they or their animals had been bewitched. Legal action was taken against at least 144 people, 38 of them male, who were accused of practicing witchcraft. 19 were executed by hanging, one was crushed by heavy stones. Historical and sociological analyses of witch trials have generally explained these outbreaks as responses to a group experiencing either a sense of threat from outside or division and loss of cohesion within. In Salem, a terrifying border war had broken out a few years earlier against the French and their Native American allies in what is now Maine, but was at that time part of Massachusetts. The townspeople were still anxious about attacks. Do the campus events making national headlines since the fall of 2015 fit into this sociological framework? One of my favorite thinkers of all time is Émile Durkheim, the 19th to early 20th century French sociologist. Durkheim saw groups and communities as being in some ways like organisms, social entities that have a chronic need to enhance their internal cohesion and their shared sense of moral order. Durkheim described human beings as homo duplex, or two-level man. We are very good at being individuals pursuing our everyday goals, which Durkheim called the level of the profane or ordinary. But we also have the capacity to transition, temporarily, to a higher collective plane, which Durkheim called the level of the sacred. He said that we have access to a set of emotions that we experience only when we are part of a collective, feelings like collective effervescence, which Durkheim described as social electricity, generated when a group gathers and achieves a state of union. You've probably felt this while doing things like playing a team sport or singing in a choir or during religious worship. People can move back and forth between these two levels throughout a single day, and it is the function of religious rituals to pull people up to the higher collective level, bind them to the group, and then return them to daily life with their group identity and loyalty strengthened. Rituals in which people sing or dance together or chant in unison are particularly powerful. A Durkheimian approach is particularly helpful when applied to sudden outbreaks of moralistic violence that are mystifying to outsiders. In 1978, the sociologist Albert Bergeson wrote an essay titled "A Durkheimian Theory of Witch Hunts with the Chinese Cultural Revolution of 1966 to 1969 as an example." Bergeson used Durkheim to illuminate the madness that erupted in Beijing in May 1966, when Mao Zedong began warning about the rising threat of infiltration by pro-capitalist enemies. Zealous college students responded by forming the Red Guards to find and punish enemies of the revolution. Universities across the country were shut down for several years. During those years, The Red Guards rooted out any trace they could find, or imagine, of capitalism, foreign influence, or bourgeois values. In practice, this meant that anyone who was successful or accomplished was suspect, and many professors, intellectuals, and campus administrators were imprisoned or murdered. Among the many cruel features of the Cultural Revolution were the struggle sessions, in which those accused of ideological impurity were surrounded by their accusers, taunted, humiliated, and sometimes beaten as they confessed to their crimes, offered abject apologies, and vowed to do better. Students sometimes turned on their own teachers. Over the next few years, tens of millions were persecuted and hundreds of thousands were murdered. How could such an orgy of self-destruction have happened? Bergesen notes that there are three features common to most political witch hunts. They arise very quickly, they involve charges of crimes against the collective, and the offenses that lead to charges are often trivial or fabricated. Here's how Bergesen puts it. Feature number one, they arise quickly. Witch hunts seem to appear in dramatic outbursts. They are not a regular feature of social life. A community seems to suddenly find itself infested with all sorts of subversive elements which pose a threat to the collectivity as a whole. Whether one thinks of the Reign of Terror during the French Revolution, the Stalinist show trials, or the McCarthy period in the United States, the phenomenon is the same. A community becomes intensely mobilized to rid itself of internal enemies. Feature number two, crimes against the collective. The various charges that appear during one of these witch hunts involve accusations of crimes committed against the nation as a corporate whole. It is the whole of collective existence that is at stake. It is the nation, the people, the revolution, or the state, which is being undermined and subverted. Feature number three, charges are often trivial or fabricated. These crimes and deviations seem to involve the most petty and insignificant behavioral acts, which are somehow understood as crimes against the nation as a whole. In fact, one of the principal reasons we term these events witch hunts is that innocent people are so often involved and falsely accused. To Bergesen's list, we'll add a fourth feature, which necessarily follows from the first three. Fear of defending the accused. When a public accusation is made, many friends and bystanders know that the victim is innocent, but they are afraid to say anything. Anyone who comes to the defense of the accused is obstructing the enactment of a collective ritual. Siding with the accused is truly an offense against the group, and it will be treated as such. If passions and fears are intense enough, people will even testify against their friends and family members. Does Bergesen's Durkheimian analysis of the Cultural Revolution help to explain the dramatic events that have been happening on campus since 2015, some of which we described in the previous chapter? As historical events, the two movements are radically different, most notably in that the Red Guards were supported by a totalitarian dictator who encouraged them to use violence, while the American college students have been self-organized and almost entirely nonviolent. Yet there are similarities, too. For example, both movements were initiated by idealistic students fighting for what seemed to them a noble ideal, the remaking of society along egalitarian lines. Bergesen's analysis captures the fact that both movements began with dramatic outbursts, which were followed by intense and rapid mobilization on college campuses across the country. It also captures the fact that large reactions are often launched in response to small acts, such as Erica Christakis's email about Halloween costumes at Yale and Mary Spellman's use of the word mold when reaching out to a student at Claremont McKenna College. Outside observers were often unable to comprehend how these two emails could have triggered mass movements demanding that the two women be denounced and fired. Bergesen's approach also works well when applied to the violence at Middlebury College. The videos of the main shoutdown show students chanting, singing, and at times swaying in unison to prevent Charles Murray from speaking. It's a striking demonstration of Durkheim's collective effervescence, building up a charge of social electricity that prepares the group for action. Research shows that synchronous movements like singing and swaying make groups more cooperative and make people who participate physically stronger in challenges they undertake right afterward. Perhaps the violent attack on Professor Stenger would not have taken place if Murray had been moved out immediately and the students had not had so much time to sway and chant in unison. We call a campaign a witch hunt when we believe that the targets of the attacks, such as Erica Christakis and Mary Spellman, are innocent. But even if we are right, that does not mean that the people doing the hunting lack any valid reason for their anger and fear. By 2015, most people had seen videos of police officers shooting or choking unarmed black men. It is understandable that many black students were on edge, felt a generalized sense of threat, and became increasingly active in movements to oppose systemic racism, particularly in the criminal justice system. But why did college students direct so much of their passion and effort toward changing their universities and to finding enemies within their own communities? And here's a related puzzle. Why were the protests strongest and most common at schools known for progressive politics in the most progressive parts of the United States, New England and the West Coast? Are these not the schools that are already the most devoted to enacting progressive and inclusive social policies? To advance in our inquiry, let's switch our focus away from students for a moment. We will examine a trend among professors that seems to fit the Durkheimian framework quite well: the use of open letters of denunciation. Professors try to round up hundreds of other professors to condemn a fellow professor or to demand that an academic article be retracted rather than simply rebutting it. Something has been changing among the faculty as well as among the students. We'll examine these changes in the broader national context of rising political polarization in the next chapter, when we'll examine the role that provocation from the right from off campus plays in these unusual events on campus. A provocative idea. On March 29, 2017, Hypatia, a journal of feminist philosophy, posted to its website an article titled In Defense of Transracialism. In the essay, Rebecca Tuvel, an assistant professor of philosophy at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, juxtaposed the largely positive public reaction to news of Caitlyn Jenner's gender transition from man to woman with the ridicule and condemnation that accompanied the revelation that Rachel Dolezal, a former chapter president of the NAACP, a civil rights organization, was not black, but rather a white woman who claimed that she identifies as black. Tuvel, noting that her concerns were not with the particulars of the Dolezal case, but with the arguments for and against transracialism, argued that while society is hostile to transracialism and more open to transgenderism, the two kinds of identity transformation raise many of the same considerations. In the article, Tuvel stressed that she is a strong advocate of transgender rights and that she was not suggesting that race and sex are equivalent. She had explored similar ideas before without controversy. Her Rhodes College webpage states that her research lies at the intersection of feminist philosophy, philosophy of race, and animal ethics. In much of her work, she considers the ways in which the oppression of animals, women, and racially subordinated groups overlap to maintain erroneous and harmful conceptions of humanity. This is a scholar who knows her way around contemporary debates and surely meant no harm to transgender people. But in today's culture of safetyism, intent no longer matters. Only perceived impact does, and thanks to concept creep, just about anything can be perceived as having a harmful, even violent, impact on vulnerable groups. According to Bergeson, anything that can be construed as an attack on a group can serve as an opportunity for collective punishment and the enhancement of group solidarity. Within a few weeks of its publication, the article had generated such an uproar that an open letter was published, addressed to an editor of Hypatia and the broader Hypatia community. The letter demanded that the article be retracted, not rebutted, but retracted. The signers were not asking for a chance to respond to Tuvel and correct her alleged mistakes, a common practice in academia. They were demanding that the article vanish from the scholarly record, a very rare occurrence usually reserved for cases of fraud or plagiarism. They contended that the continued availability of the article caused harm to women of color and the transgender community. Yet, although the letter's authors asserted that many harms were committed by the article's publishing, the alleged harm was not described. In fact, by claiming that the letter is not an exhaustive summary of the many harms caused by this article, they sidestepped their lack of evidence that the article had caused or could cause any harm at all. Individual critics were quick to chime in, calling the article transphobic, violent, and an expression of all that is wrong with white feminism. Nora Berenstain, an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Tennessee, took to Facebook to expound on the article's discursive transmisogynistic violence. She asserted that Tuvel enacts violence and perpetuates harm in numerous ways throughout her essay because she dead names a trans woman, that is, Tuvel mentioned that Jenner's former male or dead name was Bruce. She uses the term transgenderism, she talks about biological sex, and she uses phrases like male genitalia. It is striking how many of the critics' complaints refer not to Tuvel's arguments, but to her word choices. In fact, one of the arguments for retraction given in the open letter was that Tuvel used vocabulary and frameworks not recognized, accepted, or adopted by the conventions of the relevant subfields. As when Dean Spellman used the word mold in her email, petty and insignificant behavioral acts, to use Bergeson's phrase, can be considered crimes against the group as a whole. Jesse Singel, a left-leaning social science journalist, read the list of charges in the open letter and then read Tuvel's original essay. As he put it in an online article for New York Magazine, each and every one of the falsifiable points that the open letter makes is, based on a plain reading of Tuvel's article, simply false or misleading. He concluded, "All in all, it's remarkable how many basic facts this letter gets wrong about Tuvel's paper. Either the authors simply lied about the article's contents, or they didn't read it at all. Every single one of the hundreds of signatories on the open letter now has their name on a document that severely and arguably maliciously mischaracterizes the work of one of their colleagues. This is not the sort of thing that usually happens in academia. It's a really strange, disturbing instance of mass groupthink, perhaps fueled by the dynamics of online shaming and piling on." The reaction to Tuvel's article fits well into a Durkheimian framework. It is a surprising, out-of-nowhere eruption of mass groupthink, in which trivial things, such as using the phrase male genitalia, are taken as grave attacks on a vulnerable community. These attacks then warrant a collective, solidarity-boosting response, an open letter that recruits hundreds of people to publicly sign their names and collectively point their fingers at the accused witch. Singel even titled his essay, "This is what a modern-day witch hunt looks like." The Tuvel affair also shows the fourth criterion of a witch hunt, fear of defending the accused. Tuvel's PhD advisor, Kelly Oliver, wrote an essay defending her former student, in which she lamented the cowardice of so many of her colleagues. Quote, "In private messages, to Oliver and to Tuvel, some people commiserated, expressed support, and apologized for what was happening and for not going public with their support. As one academic wrote to me in a private message, 'Sorry I'm not saying this publicly, I have no interest in battling the mean girls on Facebook, but for what it's worth, it's totally obvious to me that you haven't been committing acts of violence against marginalized scholars.'" Oliver noted that some scholars went beyond cowardice, privately supporting Tuvel while publicly attacking her. Quote, "In private messages, these people apologized for what she must be going through, while in public they fanned the flames of hatred and bile on social media. The question is, Why did so many scholars, especially feminists, express one sentiment behind closed doors and another out in the open? Why were so many others afraid to say anything in public? End quote. Durkheim and Bergesen give us a direct answer to Oliver's question. This is precisely what people do during a witch hunt. Retraction is the new rebuttal. Other open letters condemning professors and demanding retraction of their work soon followed. In August 2017, two law professors, Amy Wax from the University of Pennsylvania and Larry Alexander from the University of San Diego, wrote a short opinion essay in a Philadelphia newspaper titled "Paying the Price for Breakdown of the Country's Bourgeois Culture." They argued that many of today's social problems, including unemployment, crime, drug use, and the intergenerational transmission of poverty, are partially caused by the fading away of the bourgeois cultural script that used to compel Americans to get married before you have children and strive to stay married for their sake, get the education you need for gainful employment, work hard, and avoid idleness. The authors included one particular line that caused a firestorm. All cultures are not equal, or at least, they are not equal in preparing people to be productive in an advanced economy. The line is provocative because it violates a widespread taboo in the academic world. One is not supposed to say that a dominant culture is superior to a non-dominant one in any way. But anthropologists generally agree that cultures and subcultures instill different goals, skills, and virtues in their members. And it can't possibly be true that all cultures prepare children equally well for success in all other cultures. If we want to improve outcomes for immigrants and the poor in a free market, service-oriented, capitalist economy such as ours, Wax and Alexander argued, it would be useful to talk about bourgeois culture. A week later, 54 graduate students and alumni of the University of Pennsylvania published a statement that condemned the essay and its authors for exemplifying the malignant logic of heteropatriarchal, class-based white supremacy. In good Durkheimian fashion, the open letter issued a strong call for solidarity among all members of the University of Pennsylvania community who claim to fight systemic inequality, and it included a demand that the president of the university confront the racism of Wax and Alexander and push for an investigation into Wax's advocacy for white supremacy. The call for denunciation was taken up by 33 of Wax's colleagues in the law school, nearly half the faculty, who wrote their own open letter of denunciation. They did not do what scholars are supposed to do: use their scholarly abilities to show where Wax and Alexander were wrong. They simply condemned and categorically rejected Wax's claims. Solidarity or diversity? Solidarity is great for a group that needs to work in unison or march into battle. Solidarity engenders trust, teamwork, and mutual aid. But it can also foster groupthink, orthodoxy, and a paralyzing fear of challenging the collective. Solidarity can interfere with a group's efforts to find the truth, and the search for truth can interfere with a group's solidarity. The Greek historian Thucydides saw this principle in action over 2,000 years ago. Writing about a time of wars and revolutions in the 5th century BCE, he noted that the ability to understand a question from all sides meant that one was totally unfitted for action. This is why viewpoint diversity is so essential in any group of scholars. Each professor is, like all human beings, a flawed thinker with a strong preference for believing that his or her own ideas are right. Each scholar suffers from the confirmation bias, the tendency to search vigorously for evidence that confirms what one already believes. One of the most brilliant features of universities is that, when they are working properly, they are communities of scholars who cancel out one another's confirmation biases. Even if professors often cannot see the flaws in their own arguments, other professors and students do them the favor of finding such flaws. The community of scholars then judges which ideas survive the debate. We can call this process institutionalized disconfirmation. The institution, the academy as a whole, or a discipline such as political science, guarantees that every statement offered as a research finding, and certainly every peer-reviewed article, has survived a process of challenge and vetting. That is no guarantee that it is true, but it is a reason to think that the statement is likely to be more reliable than alternative statements made by partisan think tanks, corporate marketers, or your opinionated uncle. It is only because of institutionalized disconfirmation that universities and groups of scholars can claim some authority to be arbiters of factual questions, such as whether certain vaccines caused the rise in autism. They didn't. Or whether social programs designed to help poor children close achievement gaps with wealthier kids actually work. Some do, some don't. But what would happen to a university or an academic field if everyone were on the same team and everyone shared the same confirmation bias? The disconfirmation process would break down. Research shows that reviewers go easy on articles and grant proposals that support their political team, and they are more critical of articles and proposals that contradict their team's values or beliefs. This, to some extent, is what has happened in many academic fields since the 1990s, with enormous ramifications for university culture today. It's no surprise that on the whole, professors lean left. So do artists, poets, and people who love to watch foreign movies. One of the strongest personality correlates of left-wing politics is the trait of openness to experience, a trait that describes people who crave new ideas and experiences and who tend to be interested in changing traditional arrangements. On the other hand, members of the military, law enforcement personnel, and students who have well-organized dorm rooms tend to lean right. Seriously, you can guess people's political leanings at better-than-chance levels just from photographs of their desks. Social conservatives tend to be lower on openness to experience and higher on conscientiousness. They prefer things to be orderly and predictable. They are more likely to show up on time for meetings, and they are more likely to see the value of traditional arrangements. In a free society, therefore, it will simply never be the case that every occupation is evenly balanced politically, and it will generally be the case that professors lean left, especially in the humanities and social sciences. This is not a problem as long as there are enough professors who don't lean left to guarantee institutionalized disconfirmation in any field that addresses politicized topics. A left-to-right ratio of 2 or 3 to 1 should be enough to sustain institutionalized disconfirmation, and that's about what the ratio was for most of the 20th century. Figure 5.1, which you can find on our website, shows the percentage of professors across all fields who self-identified on a survey as being on the left, the right, or middle of the road. The left-to-right ratio in the early 1990s was around 2 to 1. The few studies we have that go back to the mid-20th century generally also show that professors leaned to the left or voted for Democrats, but not by a very lopsided margin. Things began to change rapidly, however, in the late 1990s. That's when the professors from the Greatest Generation began to retire to be replaced by members of the Baby Boom Generation. Beginning in the late 1990s, the percentage of left-leaning professors goes up, surpassing 60% by 2011. The percentage of right-leaning professors goes down to 12%. By 2011, therefore, the ratio had reached 5 to 1. The Greatest Generation professors were predominantly white men who had fought in World War II and then got a boost into higher education from legislation designed to help them in the post-war period. That wave of scholars included many Republicans and many conservatives. The Baby Boom professors, in contrast, were more diverse by race and gender, but less diverse in their politics. Many of them were influenced by the great wave of social protests in the 1960s. Many went into academic careers in the social sciences and education in order to continue to fight for social justice and progressive social causes. This is why the ratio changes so much more dramatically when we look at fields that are associated with addressing social justice concerns. In my field, academic psychology, the left-to-right ratio was between 2 to 1 and 4 to 1 from the 1930s through the mid-1990s. But then it began to shoot upward, reaching 17 to 1 by 2016. The ratios in other core fields in the humanities and social sciences are nearly all above 10 to 1. The imbalance is larger at more prestigious universities and in New England. The only field among all of the humanities and social sciences that is known to have enough political diversity to allow for institutionalized disconfirmation is economics, where the left-to-right ratio found in a study of the voter registrations of professors was a comparatively low 4 to 1. The loss of political diversity among professors, particularly in fields that deal with politicized content, can undermine the quality and rigor of scholarly research. Six social scientists, including me, wrote an academic article in 2015 that explains how. For example, when a field lacks political diversity, researchers tend to congregate around questions and research methods that generally confirm their shared narrative, while ignoring questions and methods that don't offer such support. The loss of political diversity among the faculty has negative consequences for students, too, in three ways. First, there's the problem that many college students have little or no exposure to professors from half of the political spectrum. Many students graduate with an inaccurate understanding of conservatives, politics, and much of the United States. 3 days after Donald Trump's wildly unexpected electoral victory, the editors of Harvard's main student newspaper made exactly this case in an editorial invoking Harvard's motto, Veritas, the Latin word for truth, calling on the administration to give them more political diversity. Quote, "The pursuit of veritas, which undergirds our intellectual life, demands not only that each member of our community be able to debate politics freely, but also that we attend to the multitude of political views that exist in our nation. Stifling this discussion on campus is a disservice to our peers in the campus political minority and to our own educational growth." End quote. Second, the loss of viewpoint diversity among faculty means that what students learn about politically controversial topics will often be left-shifted from the truth. There is a range of reasonable opinions on many factual questions. For example, how much does raising the minimum wage cause employers to hire fewer low-skilled workers? How much of an influence do prenatal hormones have on the differing toy and play preferences of boys versus girls? But students in politically homogeneous departments will mostly be exposed to books and research studies drawn from the left half of the range, so they are likely to come down to the left of the truth on average. For example, they are likely to underestimate the elasticity of labor demand, especially if they attended prestigious universities in New England. Sometimes the left-leaning view turns out to be correct, sometimes it's the right-leaning view, but on average, students will get closer to the truth if they are exposed to debates among credentialed scholars who approach difficult problems from differing perspectives. To compound this second problem, during the same period in which the faculty were becoming more politically homogeneous, so were the students. Surveys of incoming freshmen conducted by the Higher Education Research Institute show that roughly 20% of incoming students identify as conservative, and that figure has held steady since the early 1980s. Self-described moderates made up roughly half of all incoming students in the 1980s and 1990s. But that figure has been dropping since the early 2000s. It's now in the low 40s, as the percentage of progressives, self-described liberals, rises into the high 30s. The shift has accelerated since 2012. We are not saying there's anything inherently wrong with the increasing number of left-leaning students on campus. But we are saying that viewpoint diversity is necessary for the development of critical thinking, while viewpoint homogeneity, whether on the left or the right, leaves a community vulnerable to groupthink and orthodoxy. If both the faculty and the students have been losing moderates and gaining progressives since the 1990s, and if this shift among students has accelerated since 2012, then we would expect to see some changes in the culture and social dynamics of American universities, especially after 2012. This is the third problem. It is the Durkheimian problem. It is the risk that some academic communities, particularly those in the most progressive parts of the country, may attain such high levels of political homogeneity and solidarity that they undergo a phase change, taking on properties of a collective entity that are antithetical to the normal aims of a university. A collective entity mobilized for action is more likely to enforce political orthodoxy and less likely to tolerate challenges to its key ideological beliefs. Politically homogeneous communities are more susceptible to witch hunts, particularly when they feel threatened from outside. Welcome to Evergreen. The Evergreen State College, a small public college an hour's drive south of Seattle, has long had a reputation for quirky progressivism. The college is located on a nature reserve and has its own organic farm. Instead of grades, students receive narrative reports. It has been listed as one of the 10 most liberal colleges in the country. In 2011, the college changed its mission statement to include this: Evergreen supports and benefits from local and global commitment to social justice, diversity, environmental stewardship, and service in the public interest. In May of 2017, Evergreen slipped into a state of anarchy that is difficult to explain without the help of Durkheim. Campus tensions had already been rising when, on March 15th, Brett Weinstein, a politically progressive biology professor, emailed a faculty listserv to express his concern about plans for that year's Day of Absence, which was scheduled to take place the following month. Inspired by a Douglas Turner Ward play of the same name, staff and faculty members of color, and later students too, had been spending one day off campus each year since the 1970s in order to make their absence, and thus the importance of their contributions, felt. In the wake of Donald Trump's election, however, the organizers of the 2017 event decided to make a change. Instead of the day being an opportunity for people of color to voluntarily absent themselves, this year, white students and faculty were asked to stay away from campus. Professor Weinstein thought this was wrong. He wrote, "There is a huge difference between a group or coalition deciding to voluntarily absent themselves from a shared space in order to highlight their vital and underappreciated roles, and encouraging another group to go away. In a shared space, one's right to speak or to be," he said, "must never be based on skin color." He also feared that white students and faculty who did not support the structure of the day of absence and chose to come to campus that day would be viewed negatively. Their very presence might be interpreted to mean they did not support the goals of the event. Weinstein had expressed other concerns about the direction the college was taking when, a year earlier, the college president, administrators, and select faculty committed to a campus-wide equity agenda, including a proposed policy that would require all new employees to have an equity justification. The president of Evergreen, George Bridges, had begun using the phrase "education, solidarity, inclusion" in his memos and mailings. He and his Equity Council had also undertaken various solidarity-building exercises, one of which included an event during which faculty were publicly pressured by name to get into an imaginary canoe in which the faculty and administration then symbolically journeyed toward equity together to the sounds of crashing waves and a Native American drumbeat. These rituals and talk of campus-wide solidarity make sense from a Durkheimian perspective. They are ways to prepare a community for collective action. The day of absence came and went almost without incident, according to Weinstein, although not all white members of the community complied. But more than a month later, on May 23rd, after other instances of campus unrest, a multi-ethnic group of angry students marched to Weinstein's classroom door, cornered him in the hallway, and berated him. They swore at him, calling him a piece of shit and telling him to get the fuck out. They claimed that he made racist statements in his email, and they demanded that he not only apologize, but also resign. Weinstein disagreed with their assessment of his email as harmful and racist, and he refused to apologize. But he did try to engage the students in discussion, or, as he called it, dialectic, which does mean I listen to you and you listen to me. The response was not positive. "We don't care what terms you want to speak on. We are not speaking on terms of white privilege." The students continued to blast the professor, and tensions mounted. Concerned for Weinstein's safety, his students contacted the police, but protesters physically prevented the police from reaching him. Campus police requested backup from other police departments. Protesters, claiming to be fearful for their lives, marched on to the administration building, where they found and confronted President Bridges outside his office. Videos of the event show protesters saying, "Fuck you, George. We don't want to hear a goddamn thing you have to say. You shut the fuck up." The president agreed to meet with protesters, along with the staff and administrators who supported them, and then assured them that, with respect to errant faculty in the sciences, such as Weinstein, quote, "They're going to say some things we don't like, and our job is to bring them all in or get them out. And what I hear us stating that we're working toward is bring them in, train them, and if they don't get it, sanction them," end quote. Yes, that is the president of a U.S. public college, which is bound by the First Amendment to protect academic freedom, proposing to fire or punish professors who do not accept the teachings of a mandatory political re-education program. Some of the protesters insisted that campus police chief Stacey Brown join the meeting unarmed. Brown, who would not disarm in uniform, changed into civilian clothes and arrived to find students shouting expletives and slurs, some directed at her. Certain protesters were assigned to her and followed her to another meeting later in the day, attended by hundreds of others. At this larger gathering, protesters attached themselves to Brown, Weinstein, and a few other non-compliant faculty and students. At all times, the protesters controlled the exits. When Weinstein's students overheard protesters say they had mace and planned to prevent Weinstein from leaving the building, they texted him to alert him. Weinstein texted his wife, Heather Hying, a fellow biology professor, "I am told I will not be allowed to leave," and then, "not sure what to do." Video of that meeting is startling. Student protesters can be heard insisting that Weinstein be fired in order to prevent him from what one white protester later described as spreading this problematic rhetoric. Students of color who spoke supportively of Weinstein, or who even asked to hear from people not in the protesters' camp, were shouted down and called race traitors. White students who were not protesting were told to stand in the back and were not allowed to speak. Students repeatedly and publicly ridiculed the college president, even berating him for smiling. One student yelled at President Bridges, who often gesticulates with his hands, "Put your hand down!" While another student mockingly imitated his hand gestures, adding, "That's my problem with you, George. You keep making these little hand movements." The president immediately put his hands behind his back as the student walked around him to laughter and applause, announcing that she was decolonizing the space. Bridges responded, "My hands are down." The next day, May 24th, protesters searched cars looking for Weinstein. They interrupted a faculty meeting and took the cake meant to celebrate retiring faculty while asking, "Didn't you educate us on how to do shit like this?" Then, according to the student newspaper, student protesters barricaded the main entrance to the administration building and for several hours, having occupied the building and gathered together the leadership of the college, including President Bridges, they held them in an office. With the leadership team sequestered, the students prepared and later presented their demands. These included mandatory bias training for faculty and permission for protesters to not turn in their homework on time. Outside the office, students video recorded themselves making sure that the room had no escape routes and that there was enough student presence to prevent administrators from leaving. Bridges ordered the campus police not to intervene. One organizer of the protest told students there was a room for them to rest and advised protesters to Make sure you're all taking care of yourselves in these moments. Immediately after giving those instructions, the same organizer entered the president's office and asked the administrators if they needed anything. Bridges is seen on video saying, "I need to pee." The organizer replies, "Hold it," as several people laugh. Protesters later escorted Bridges to the bathroom. Inside the president's office, one student protester asked captive administrators, "Don't you think it's continuing white supremacy when the leadership is only white people?" Several administrators nodded and said yes, thereby validating the student's grossly expanded definition of white supremacy. Outside the office, students chanted, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, these racist faculty have got to go." That night, in an email to the campus community, an Evergreen Media Studies professor wrote approvingly that the protesting students were doing exactly what we've taught them. The following day, May 25th, the police received information that protesters intended to target the campus police department building. Ordered to stand down, the police evacuated, setting up a post off campus and monitoring the highly charged situation using campus security cameras and a local law enforcement helicopter. Students who defended Weinstein were stalked and were targeted by protesters in thinly veiled online threats. The campus police chief informed Weinstein that, out of concern for his safety, she thought it would be best if he left campus. He held all but one of his remaining classes that quarter off campus. Aside from his wife, Heather Hying, only one professor on the entire faculty, Mike Paros, a professor of veterinary science, publicly supported Weinstein. Weinstein later learned that several other professors were supportive, but afraid to say so in public. With so little public support, with the police urging him to stay off campus, and with no national media covering the story of Evergreen's descent into anarchy and intimidation, on May 26th, Weinstein accepted an invitation to be interviewed on the Fox News TV show Tucker Carlson Tonight. Once the story went public, it attracted attention from the political right and harassment from the alt-right, which we will discuss further in the next chapter. On Thursday, June 1st, a man in New Jersey called the Thurston County Emergency Line and told the dispatcher he was on his way to Evergreen to execute as many people on campus as I can get a hold of. Law enforcement informed the school that there was no active threat, but as a precautionary measure, the campus was shut down until Saturday, June 3rd. On June 3rd and 4th, bands of students began to roam the campus armed with baseball bats and tasers, searching for white supremacists. They vandalized buildings and assaulted several students. The New Jersey man was arrested a month later. How did this mess end? Who was held accountable? On June 2nd, roughly a quarter of the college's faculty signed a letter calling for Weinstein to be investigated, blaming him for provoking white supremacist backlash, and claiming that by speaking about what was happening on Fox News TV, he endangered students. Weinstein and Hying rejected the assertion that he was to blame. As employees of Evergreen, they filed a tort claim against the college for tolerating and even endorsing egregious violations of the student conduct code, including criminal behavior, and for fostering a racially hostile work environment. In September 2017, the couple and Evergreen agreed on a settlement, and the professors resigned. Police Chief Stacey Brown later made similar charges, claiming that the hostile environment left her with no choice but to resign from the college. President Bridges, who at the beginning of the year had criticized the University of Chicago for its policy protecting free speech and academic freedom, agreed to many of the protesters' demands. He announced that he was grateful for the passion and courage the protesters displayed, and later he hired one of the leaders of the protests to join his presidential equity advisors. One of their primary tasks was to rewrite the student code of conduct. Great Untruth You. The events at Evergreen illustrate just about everything we've talked about in this book so far. The early stages illustrate Bergesen's three features of political witch hunts. The movement seemed to come out of nowhere. It was in response to a trivial provocation, a polite email sent to a faculty listserv. And the provocation was interpreted as an attack on the entire Evergreen community. As the drama unfolded, it illustrated our fourth criterion. Faculty and administrators who wanted to defend Weinstein were afraid to do so. The protesting Evergreen students and the faculty and administrators who encouraged them repeatedly displayed all three of the great untruths. For example, one professor who supported the protesters addressed some of her faculty colleagues in an angry monologue that included a line similar to the untruth of fragility, "What doesn't kill you makes you weaker." "I am too tired. This shit is literally gonna kill me." A student illustrated the untruth of emotional reasoning, always trust your feelings, at the large town hall meeting when she used her own anxiety as evidence that something was very wrong at Evergreen. "I want to cry. I can't tell you how fast my heart is beating. I am shaking in my boots." And of course, the entire episode was an illustration of the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. The protesting students and their faculty supporters engaged in a giant game of common enemy identity politics by interpreting a politically progressive college and its politically progressive leadership and faculty as exemplars of white supremacy in action. As one student who refused to join the protesters later put it while testifying before the college trustees, "If you offer any kind of alternative viewpoint, you're the enemy." Evergreen State College is not typical. With the exception of the Milo riot at UC Berkeley, its meltdown into anarchy in the spring of 2017 is more extreme than anything else that has happened in recent decades on an American college campus, as far as we know. We have presented its story in detail because it is a warning to everyone who cares about students or universities. The Evergreen story shows what is possible when political diversity is reduced to very low levels, when the school's leadership is weak and easily intimidated, and when professors and administrators allow or even encourage the propagation of the three great untruths. In sum, 1. Humans are tribal creatures who readily form groups to compete with other groups, as we saw in Chapter 3. Sociologist Emile Durkheim's work illuminates the way those groups engage in rituals, including the collective punishment of deviance, to enhance their cohesion and solidarity. 2. Cohesive and morally homogeneous groups are prone to witch hunts, particularly when they experience a threat, whether from outside or from within. 3. Witch hunts generally have four properties. They seem to come out of nowhere. They involve charges of crimes against the collective. The offenses that lead to those charges are often trivial or fabricated. And people who know that the accused is innocent keep quiet, or, in extreme cases, they join the mob. 4. Some of the most puzzling campus events and trends since 2015 match the profile of a witch hunt. The campus protests at Yale, Claremont McKenna, and Evergreen all began as reactions to politely worded emails and all led to demands that the authors of the emails be fired. We repeat that the concerns that provide the context for a witch hunt may be valid, but in a witch hunt, the attendant fears are channeled in unjust and destructive ways. 5. The new trend in 2017 for professors to join open letters denouncing their colleagues and demanding the retraction or condemnation of their work, as happened to Rebecca Tuvel, Amy Wax, and others, also fits this pattern. In all of these cases, colleagues of the accused were afraid to publicly stand up and defend them. 6. Viewpoint diversity reduces a community's susceptibility to witch hunts. One of the most important kinds of viewpoint diversity, diversity of political thought, has declined substantially among both professors and students at American universities since the 1990s. These declines, combined with the rapidly escalating political polarization of the United States, which is our focus in the next chapter, may be part of the reason why the new culture of safetyism has spread so rapidly since its emergence around 2013. This concludes part two of this book. In these two chapters, we examine some dramatic events that occurred on American college campuses in the 2 years after we published our article in The Atlantic laying out our concerns about cognitive distortions on campus. The new campus trends make a lot more sense once you understand the three great untruths and can spot them in action. In part three, we'll ask, why and why now? Where did the three great untruths and the culture of safetyism come from? And why did they spread so quickly in the last few years?